You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of March 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
Hello, everybody. Well, as Chief of Mission just stated, it's been nearly 90 years since a U.S. president stepped foot in Cuba. It is wonderful to be here.
An American president is in Cuba. But aside from the symbolism, does it really matter? My guests, Daniela Peled and Robert Fox, will give us their views on this and the day's other big stories, including Greece asked for logistical help from the European Union in order to implement the deal with Turkey aimed at stemming the flow of refugees. And in the US, the two most likely presidential candidates, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, turn their attention to Israel. We'll analyse their speeches. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Peled, Acting Managing Editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Robert Fox, the London Evening Standard Defence Editor. The wheels of Air Force One touched down in Cuba for the first time yesterday, starting a history-making presidential visit by Barack Obama. It's nearly 90 years since the US president last set foot in the country. In the time since, US presidents have perhaps been more likely to be plotting how to kill off a Castro rather than planning to shake hands with one. But after President Obama unfroze relations with the Caribbean island last year, embassies have reopened and discussions have begun. A few hours ago, Obama was received by Cuban President Raul Castro in Havana's Palace of the Revolution, the same place where Castro and his predecessor, older brother Fidel, have led Cuba's so-called resistance to the US over the last few decades. Robert Fox, is it actually, when we look at what's happening with the US and Cuba, because this has now taken place over the last few months and we've kind of got used to the fact that relations are being normalised and the world hasn't really ended and now this is happening, are we perhaps underestimating how big a thing this is? The fact that Barack Obama was able to end 50 years of political orthodoxy and say, you know what, this is silly.
There's a lot of symbolism in it, absolutely, and it is his gesture at ending an old Cold War, quite a local Cold War. And it is important. But it isn't Mr. Nixon goes to China. It is not of that scale. I think it's very interesting as to how the world works now. It was something that Obama quite rightly always wanted to do. He was quite clear. But interestingly, why it isn't the Cold War, or the ending of the Cold War, is there is no Nikita Khrushchev / Vladimir Putin leading over the shoulder. As far as I can't recall Putin saying anything over much about this. Where it puts Cuba and where it puts Latin America and where it puts the organization of American states is very, very interesting, because in the latter days of the Castro's brothers, it's been a bit of a failure, and they were looking for economic rescue, and they looked for economic... Daniel, I guess, actually knows far more about it than I do, but it's quite clear that one of their big hopes was going to be Venezuela with Chavez, and that just hasn't happened. What I fear, and I'll finish with this, is that it's going to revert to type. It will become an offshore mafia haven again.
Daniela, it's interesting when you compare the Obama strategy, not just towards Cuba, but... the leftists in Latin America, if we can be that broad, to, for example, the previous administration under George W. Bush, they haven't made out, you know, Hugo Chavez and then Nicolas Maduro after him to be the enemy or a grave threat to America. The same with Cuba. They've seen them as, well, we don't agree with them, but we're quite happy to deal with the rest of Latin America. And if you want a grown-up relationship with us, then we'll have one. It's been a very different type of attitude towards Latin America, hasn't it?
It has, and I think what Obama has done with Cuba is, I mean, I've used the word historic numerous times in recent weeks. It's a horrible cliche. It is true. But at the same time, it's also true that the embargo really outlived its usefulness or any kind of political sense. What happens now is much more important than this sort of all the attention of this two-day visit. Politically motivated tensions in Cuba have absolutely soared in the last couple of months as compared to previous years. Now, you can look at this and say, well, people have been encouraged by the detente, and so people are more active and they're protesting more. Or you can say, and I think this is possibly more likely, that the regime are thinking, well, we've got this far, we're going to get quite a lot out of this and quite a lot of diplomatic recognition, and only lip service about human rights. I mean, the Cuban opposition is genuinely divided over whether this is a good move or not, whether Obama should have come now, and really what they're going to get in return.
There is this danger, isn't there, Robert, that it appears as if all the US is really interested in is trade, and actually democracy and human rights are kind of a little bit lower down the list of priorities.
It's very interesting what Daniela has just been saying, because I think I follow you up to a point. But I do think we are in the era of social media and the internet and so on, and this thing really does count, and the protests do count.
It's not the era of social media if you're living in Cuba, though.
Yeah, no, but I was just thinking, what it smells to me like, politically, is we are at the fin de regime in Cuba. They'll go on for a bit. It feels very much like, I'm not saying the military dictatorships, but dictatorships in some aspects it certainly is, and that it is coming to its end. What we have to watch now is the freedom of movement and the way the migrants treat it, and the immigrant populations we know in the southern United States are very, very right-wing about this and what they may try to leverage out of this. But let's go back to Obama very briefly, and I'm not at all critical. The one thing we're getting from Obama is that his reflections and his diplomacy, I sound like Mary Duchevsky now, but it is absolutely so, and it was in the film that Margaret Percy just did about him. Here is a very, very reasonable man who thinks things through. He may not come to very dynamic, positive, forward-looking or visionary political conclusions, but this is a bit of the tidying up. It is, I think, in a way, almost more than it is for the Castros and for Cuba itself, it is a very important piece in the jigsaw known as that funny old thing, the Obama legacy.
It's funny how you say he's a reasonable man who thinks things through.
Which often leads to inaction.
Well, no, I was going to say, a lot of people often weirdly sometimes use that as a stick to beat him with.
Yes, because of the reason because it leads to inaction. And sorry, we're getting onto another, but it is fascinating about this man, where so often he has spotted that inaction, as far as he can see, is far less dangerous than action. And of course, he's got a big background, and it's primarily 2003 in Iraq.
But it depends then what we mean by action. Surely there is action of a different sort, which is saying, I'm going to act and end this ridiculous embargo with Cuba, and we're going to have normal relations.
Well, since you've heard me, I'll quickly answer that question. Absolutely right. It is what the engagement is now, and that I'm not clear about.
Daniela Pellet, Barack Obama is going to have one slight problem if he brings up human rights in Cuba, which is that Raul Castro can say, oh, very interesting, Mr. President. Should we talk about that big prison that you've got on our island called Guantanamo?
And he has been talking about it an awful lot. I mean, the Cuban media has been focusing on Guantanamo and pushing that message. And considering that there's, I think, quite a high level of cynicism amongst Cuban people about the revolution and what it's actually brought them, that has been quite a significant point. That's what many people are talking about. That, but that is, I mean, it sounds an awful thing to say, but I mean, that's a relatively small issue in this rapprochement. It's one of those strange anomalies that the US has had control of this. Of this small piece of land. I mean, Guantanamo has embarrassed not just Obama, but his predecessor as well. It's Obama's legacy. He's got that. It's in the bag. But what I think what's interesting is what the next president will do, because allowing, you know, Google and Amazon and McDonald's into Cuba isn't going to somehow magically transform its economy or even its social makeup or its ideological background. For the last two decades, there's been a movement towards loosening up and greater freedom. So the quintapropistas, the small-scale entrepreneurs, there is, you know, limited internet access allowed on the island now. The Cubans are allowed to leave more freely. But none of this has actually heralded massive change. I mean, this change has been heralded for decades now, and it's not happening. And I think a good sign of what Cubans think is how the immigration has absolutely soared over the last year. I mean, through the land route, through Central America, through Mexico, vast masses of people trying to make it there because they don't know what will happen when the bilateral relations are completely agreed and their preferential conditions for arriving in America no longer exist. They don't feel terribly hopeful about the future.
And that's the problem, Robert, isn't it? In that if we're talking about, you know, the hope for a future in Cuba that is more democratic, more open, more free, there are limits to what outside nations, whether that is the United States or whether that's, you know, Norway, which has had good relations with Cuba for some time, or whether that's even Russia or whoever. There's very little that actually outside nations can really do here.
I think you raised something that's quite extraordinary, because you may remember it's things that united such that you can have in mainstream politics in the US, right and left. Because in a funny way, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama have been absolutely soppy about democracy. Democracy is the great thing. Remember the Cairo speech by Obama. Just don't think that I'm going off beast here. The way Clinton preached, and above all, W. thought you were going to bring democracy to Afghanistan and the Middle East. That was allegedly the prospectus. And it's not delivering. What is very interesting about the second decade of the 21st century is that it doesn't compute. And a thing that you raised, which is very interesting about entitlement, is if you don't think it's going to work for you, you move.
But sorry, just to bring you back onto this point of democracy, because it's, you say Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama are, as you term it, soppy about democracy. Yeah. George W. Bush wasn't that soppy about democracy, for example, in the West Bank or in Gaza. He said, we're very much in favour of it. Oh, and now you voted for Hamas. Well, actually, no, we're not in favour of it now.
And Tony Blair likewise, because a lot of us who were advising and into our public columns said, actually, an election is going to deliver you a Hamas victory.
Well, and we can say the same with the Arab Spring as well, so-called. You know, in Egypt, there was an election. You know, Mohamed Morsi was elected, but, you know, actually the US were quite happy when El-Sisi came into, as John Kerry called it, restoring democracy, Daniela. There is this problem, isn't it, that it's, we like democracy, but only if our guys actually are in charge.
Yeah, and I also think people in Iraq and people in Afghanistan and so on, they also like democracy as well. I mean, they want to have a say in how their country is run. If you look at the enormous numbers that turn out for elections, local and national elections, despite enormous security risks, I don't think it's just the US presidents who are soppy about democracy. But democracy means different things to different people.
Ah, that's the point.
That's the issue. It means far more than one person, one voice, but one vote. It also means human rights, rule of law, action against corruption.
What you're talking about is contextual politics.
Is where
politics
it gets
are very different,
a bit
and it was
more
never
complicated.
Yeah.
Okay. So before we wrap this bit up, what happens next then for Cuba? Robert Fox first. You know, there'll be this visit. Obama will go.
Yeah, for the reason that Daniela has absolutely said. Goodness knows what the next president is going to do. And it could be even with a Hillary, Trump, possibly Bloomberg. No, he's out of it. I mean, goodness knows how they're going to play it. Particularly with the Republicans, I think very, very strong interest groups and lobbies will come into play there. But think of the poor Cubans, and I really mean the poor Cubans. They want to be lifted out of what they see as relative poverty, and I think that's what the next president really must address.
Is it, Daniela, actually going to be down to the next US president too much as to what happens next in Cuba?
Yes, it is. And I think the prospects could be good. They could be really good. They're a super enterprising group of people in Cuba. They've had to be, given their recent history. But the US really and absolutely has to has to insist that there has to be action on human rights and democratization. It's not going to come about from the bottom up through economic means. That's not going to happen. And that's, I think, the greatest risk. They'll say, right, we're going to bring in this limited free market. We're going to bring in job opportunities and wow, democracy will follow. That's not going to happen in Cuba.
OK, well, let's move on now to another country that has an interesting relationship with the US. In just a few hours, the Republican frontrunner Donald Trump is scheduled to address the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the leading pro-Israel group in the US. Nearly all the presidential candidates are speaking at the AIPAC conference, but most eyes will perhaps be on Trump, who's gained attention for somewhat contradictory statements on Israel. AIPAC is a major gathering for politicians and Jewish leaders every year. There is one presidential contender who isn't going to be speaking, though, and that is Bernie Sanders, who is the first Jewish politician to ever win a presidential primary and to actually have something of a shout. He said that his campaigning in Western states ahead of voting in Arizona, Idaho and Utah would not allow him to make the trip to Washington, D.C. And Daniela Pelled, when he said he wanted to speak by video, they said, no, you can't do that. Is this because his views are perhaps slightly to the left of most of AIPAC's leaders?
Well, I don't actually think so, because AIPAC, interesting thing about it, is that so far, or historically, it's been a non-partisan organisation. And Benjamin Netanyahu has kind of shifted that a bit with his insistence on it, on using it to lobby over Iran and so on and so forth. But the delegates at AIPAC really span the spectrum from, well, from liberal left-wing Zionist to right-wing Zionist. But even so, there's plenty of opposition figures from Israel speaking. There's plenty of left-leaning rabbis and community leaders. It's likely there's going to be some protests when Donald Trump takes the podium. But I think Bernie Sanders has been fairly clever in this, because he has also a constituency that doesn't really support his kind of fairly, you know, liberal, middle of the road, left-wing Zionist belief. So better to just avoid it with quite a good excuse. And then it also pleases people who think that speaking at AIPAC somehow legitimizes them. And it's also, I'd like to say, not so much about being Jewish, because the Christian Zionist right in America is, I think, more influential than the Jewish community, who, as we all know, are mostly Democrats.
We'll come on to sort of the Jewish community, as it were, in the US in a moment. But Robert, Donald Trump has been criticised by some within the Republican Party for saying that he would be, quote, neutral on the issue of Israel and Palestine, which they took great offence at, because, of course, you shouldn't be neutral in any way. You should back Israel all the time. And this is actually one of the rare occasions where Donald Trump has modified his views to fit in better with the Republican establishment.
I think it's very interesting, and it actually shows the kind of political intelligence that Trump undoubtedly somewhere has, and few people give him credit for. And the fact is that the relationship between the US administration and Israel has been skewed very, very seriously by a clash of two personalities, by Obama and Netanyahu. And there is a great concern about this, because the peace process is going absolutely nowhere. It should be declared dead. Netanyahu is going on his way. Expects, carte blanche endorsement from organisations like AIPAC, but particularly the administration. Funny enough, I think it puts somebody like Hillary Clinton, because they have a strong Zionist support credential, the Clinton family, in rather a difficult position. It's absolutely ironic that both Hillary and Donald Trump have Jewish sons-in-law. So, you know, that they can't be accused of anything. I think, though, it is a period of adjustment. I must say, I rather endorse what... I'm not nearly as well-versed as Daniel is. But I think there are elements in this very, very broad community that is AIPAC that are intelligent about this. Because at the moment, Middle East security, which is very, very serious indeed, isn't entirely focused on Israel for once. Because actually, you know, tutto sommato, as the Italians say, everything together, it's managing pretty well. I mean, security, military-wise, Israel is just so much ahead of the game in the region. So I think there is a, funny enough, I detect quite a bit of the heat is being taken out of this at the moment.
Daniela, it's interesting that there seems to be something of a disconnect between politicians in the US who think that they're representing you know, Jewish opinion or pro-Israeli opinion, and, as you referred to earlier, the Jewish community, Jews in America, who actually are far more in favour of a two-state solution, finding some accommodation with the Palestinians, than it seems their representatives are at times.
Well, you could say that even about the British Jewish community. I mean, this is, I think there's a feeling that some sort of solidarity must be shown. I think support for Israel in America goes very far beyond the Jewish community. It's broad, it's genuine, it's strategic, and it's also instinctive as well. APAC, you know, the conspiracy theorists see that it has all this great amount of power and it does have great lobbying potential, but actually it reflects genuine support for Israel within the American political system. And of course, that doesn't have to be Netanyahu's version of what's good for Israel. But they will be fundamentally support for a Israeli administration. I mean, it's key to Washington's policy in the Middle East.
We'll leave it there. Daniela Pellad and Robert Fox, thank you both. When we return, we'll be talking about Greece, refugees, and possibly, if there's time, Iran.
How do you write a biography? Are we all curators today? Who still makes fanzines? And how close are fact and fiction? These are some of the questions constantly puzzling us here at Monocle. So each week on our culture show, we spin the globe to find the very best writers, musicians, artists, gallerists, filmmakers, commentators, and even mudlarks to debunk these cultural mysteries. Tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, every Monday at 1900 UK time, where all will be revealed.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still in the studio, Daniela Pellad and Robert Fox. We're going to try and cram in two more stories before the end. I'm sure we'll work it out. We'll continue with the ongoing refugee crisis. Greece today appealed to its EU partners for logistical help to implement a deal with Turkey aimed at stemming the flow of refugees and migrants. According to the Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, his country doesn't have enough manpower to process asylum applications. Robert Fox, he's right, isn't he? But, and he's been saying this for a long time, and still his friends and colleagues in the European Union aren't helping out.
Of course he's right, but he's got a friend who finds it very difficult to speak up at the moment and realises that, you know, there's got to be some equity regarding the Greek position, and it's Angela Merkel. She said, you can't demand this, this and this as from the Greeks to pull in line on European currency stability and demand, and then say, you know, on your bike, mate, it's your responsibility, these refugees, and we're not going to help over much. They need about 2,500. I understand from the latest Greek figures, judicial figures, just officers, I mean, to help process this. And this is an enormous problem. And what worries me about the deal is the short-termism about it. Yes, you're going to do it back for now, but you look at people we've mentioned on this programme over and over again, people who really go in and stick their noses in a very intelligent way, like David Kilcullen, and saying we're facing double the flow this year, so what are you going to do about it? It's very interesting in the climate of public opinion, such that one can gauge it, that there is increasing support for Greece in Europe, and of course great scepticism about Turkey for all kinds of reasons, which I judge to be fair, and some that are unfair. First of all, there is the authoritarianism and unaccountability of Erdogan, which is extremely disturbing at times. It's very authoritarian. But now, there does seem to be a very complex terrorist campaign, which they've got to devote a lot of their security to. So how much can they really be bearing the burden of repatriating and then reintroducing refugees? A, I think it's, in the medium term, wildly impractical. B, probably it's illegal.
And immoral. I mean, it's immoral and unethical. I mean, that's the issue. It's unlikely to work, and it raises an awful lot of questions which are very disturbing. I mean, the refugees, Turkey has got a record of sending people back, and for the refugees in Turkey, I mean, people can't just be housed in enormous refugee camps. People want to work. People want to move on with their lives. And it is, it's super, super short-term thinking. And I don't really believe that Turkey will meet its obligations and receive the benefits that perhaps, apart from the money, but, you know, this sort of the visa-free access seems super implausible.
Okay. We'll move on because we have to, I'm afraid. We're going to finish with accusations from Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. According to him, the US, he claims, is seeking to undermine Iran's banks. In a televised speech, he also said that the US policy is to prevent big companies from doing business with Iran, while US presidential candidates are trying to outdo each other in their hostility to the Islamic Republic. At the same time, it's been reported that, and this is apparently true, Iran's Revolutionary Guard is planning to build a statue of the American sailors who were captured in Iranian waters earlier this year. Apparently, it would become, I kid you not, a tourist attraction. Robert Fox, I think it's fair to say, when you look at both of these stories, that Saudi Arabia's fears that Iran was going to be America's new ally in the region haven't quite been realised just yet.
But I think the problems with Saudi Arabia at the moment, given the Obama Atlantic magazine interview, which was very interesting, Saudi Arabia is beginning to emerge as big a problem as Iran. The new aggression under King Salman.
We'll have to talk about Saudi Arabia some other time. But
it's a polarity.
Indeed.
That's the two. And a lot of the stuff is, you know, Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, who's writing the script? Come on, this is joking. Where it's right is they're desperate to break out. They're desperate to get sanctions lifted. They're desperate to get their hands on the frozen funds. But in terms of shaking and moving, particularly in Syria, also in Iraq, they're doing pretty darn well. They are the swing vote. Actually, with the Putin pullout, I saw a lot of the hand of Iran behind that, because he felt trapped. He was trapped into a very interesting and very complex alliance with Shia, Iran and Hezbollah. I don't think they're doing too badly at the moment.
But, Daniela, it's fair to say the relationship with the US is not as smooth as some people were trying to claim it would be.
It's certainly not going to be smooth. There's been no sort of ideological reawakening or anything. But I think this is much more to do with internal Iranian politics than anything else. I mean, a period of detente is going to be accompanied by other people who oppose it. The hardliners wanting to make the most of one of really the most humiliating episodes in recent American history, which is the images of those sailors surrendering, the subject of a million internet memes. Who wouldn't want to cast that in bronze and turn it into a tourist attraction?
It's the next best thing to the embassy siege.
Well, indeed, yeah. And this kind of fits in with the way Iran's dealt with these sorts of things in the past. The British embassy, of course, now is on a road in Tehran called Bobby Sands Avenue, named after the Irish hunger striker.
Yes, but they're plenty sharp. But I don't think we've been duped, because I don't think necessarily they set out to do this. But the fact that we have the multilingual Rouhani and the multilingual Zarif as the leader and the foreign minister, ideologically, they've not shifted at all. And this is where Daniela is absolutely right. And this, looking into this shaking kaleidoscope of Iranian politics, goodness knows where we are going to end up. But boy, you know, they've got a grip on Syria, they've got a grip on Iraq, they've got a grip in Yemen now, and they are going places. But I think the real question is, who succeeds Khamenei, which I think must be coming up within the next three or four years.
We'll end on that note. Robert Fox, Daniela Peled, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Charlie Young. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Carlotta Ribello is here next. Then it's Culture with Rob. Do stay tuned for that. Midori House back at the same time tomorrow. 1800 here in London, 1400 at the moment in New York. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.